Welcome everybody to Health Wealth. I want to thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to bring you these very, very powerful, powerful shows. You've been following the show for a while. You know that at least several times a month, in most months, we have a special guest on talking about entrepreneurship. Very important and very interesting topic. There are a lot of people out here that have decided that they're going to strike out on their own, and they're going to, you know, they have the skills and the know-how to start their own business. But you need more than skills to do it. You got to know how to do it. And so it's with that in mind that we do these shows on entrepreneurship. Well, my special guest has written an awesome book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success. And it last time we spoke, it was 105 business principles, but now it's up to 106 business principles. So it's called Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. My special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. He's author of the book, and we are very, very pleased, again, to have him on as a regular. When talking to people about how to do stuff, right, you always want to know, well, what makes this person an expert? Why am I listening to this individual share with me how to do this or that? You want to know that at least that they've done it. I mean, and if they've done what it is that they're sharing with you how to do, then that kind of lends credibility to them. Well, when we're talking about entrepreneurship, Professor Geiger has over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. That's over half a century of experience working for himself, starting businesses, running businesses, selling businesses, growing businesses. So he's somebody that I think you need to listen to when they talk. He's also written a book on it. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about Professor Geiger before we actually get into the interview today. Currently retired, Professor Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people like yourself and myself succeed in business, he wrote Entrepreneurial Success, 101 Practical Business Principles, Road to the Top. And the book just keeps growing and growing and growing. And again, we are very fortunate to have an opportunity to sit, listen, and learn from somebody who's been doing it successfully for over half a century. So everybody get ready. Class is in session. Professor Geiger, welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's a pleasure to have you as always. Great to talk to you again.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you much.
My pleasure. Professor, let me start here with today's show. We're constantly getting new listeners, and there may be somebody sitting on the fence and, you know, trying to decide whether or not they should embark upon, you know, the whole entrepreneurial lifestyle or entrepreneurial way. And they may have the skills, and they may be kind of iffy as in terms of whether or not they actually want to take the plunge, because it can be very comfortable working for someone else. You know, you don't have to worry about the light bill. You don't have to worry about the rent of the office space. You can just come to work, you know, punch the clock, you know, do your job, go home. And, you know, if you're satisfied with the pay, you know, you take your check and, you know, live. But then there are others who, you know, say, you know, I want more. I want the freedom of owning my own business. I want to take something, I want to take this idea from its inception and grow it and, you know, watch it grow and nurture it and, you know, see it come to fruition. So from your perspective, why become an entrepreneur? You know, why, what is it about being an entrepreneur that you have found so rewarding that you have done it for over half a century? Over half a century.
Well, let's start with here in the United States, over 40% of all wage earners Let me rephrase that. All income earners, which is wage and entrepreneurs and salaries and all of that, over 40% at some point in their income producing life, they will be entrepreneurs. That means that whoever is in whatever field is in second place, they're so far back that you'd have to have a telescope to see them. 40% are going to be entrepreneurs at some point for some period of time. And unfortunately, a lot of them fail in the first year, but I think they fail because they haven't bothered to learn some of the basics. And if you bother to learn some of the basics, then that percentage is cut way, way down. And the way you learn the basics is you read a book like I have, you take a course, junior college or a college, community college course. The one thing you want to be sure is whoever teaches that course, you want to find out, have they ever actually done it? Unfortunately, an awful lot of them have not. And I wrote the book, Entrepreneurial Success, because in the first couple of years that I taught, I found that the textbooks I thought were terribly lacking. And anybody who had been an entrepreneur as long as I had could read through these things and see pretty quickly that whoever wrote them had never, ever done it. Actually, of the 10 or 12 books that I've either used or reviewed, I found one that the authors, in this case there were two of them, and both of them had actually started businesses. The other 11 books, the authors had never started a business, and most of them had never even worked for a free enterprise business. In other words, they went to high school and college and got their bachelor's and master's and PhD and immediately started teaching. And so how is a person like that going to teach anybody anything about starting a business? They were as far away from it as you can get. Academia is pretty insulated. So at any rate, that was my experience of why I started the business. And if you either take a course from somebody who's actually done it, or just, you know, the inexpensive way is to read my book. It's less than $20. And it goes through 106 very, very specific principles to help you along. And the reason there's so many of them is because when you get right down to it, there really are a whole lot of small situations that you need to get right, or at least you need to get most of them right in order to survive as a proprietor who owns their own business. And those books that says follow my five principles or three principles or whatever it is to get rich quick, what I got to tell you about that is that ain't going to happen, because there are not five, there's way over 105. So, but if you do that, there's nothing very magical about being a successful entrepreneur. It does take a lot of hard work. You have to be aware of a lot of stuff. But if you are, it's not all that difficult. The vast majority who understand the how to do it succeed. And frankly, the vast majority who don't bother to learn how to do it do not succeed.
Well, Professor, at what point did you start seeing entrepreneurship being taught at the university level or college level? Because, you know, when you look back just at business in the United States, right, you know, just looking back at, say, you know, Ford, the car companies, Ford, Chrysler, IBM, the, you know, all of the different major companies, if entrepreneurship wasn't taught in college back then, when these people started their businesses, and yet they built them into, you know, mega businesses.
Mm-hmm.
What point did entrepreneurship start being taught in the colleges, and what would you say lent to the success of those that didn't have, say, the benefit of taking a college course or having your book?
Well, I don't really know when it started. I can tell you when it didn't start. I graduated in 1960 from the University of Denver School of Business, and they were a very, very active school of business in the Rocky Mountain West. They were, if not the best, they were, you know, number two or three. They were way up there, and there was no such thing as entrepreneurship. There was no such thing even as small business management. All the classes that I took, the assumption was that you were going to go to work for Bell Telephone, IBM, Ford Motor Company, or something like that. There was nothing about how to do it as a small business. I mean, there were no courses. And so how did the Fords and all of those folks make it? They made it the same way I did. They had to go at it, and they made mistakes, and they learned pretty quickly from their mistakes what not to do. And I think my book will really tell you not only how to do things, but it'll also tell you a whole lot of things not to do. Because quite frankly, you learn a whole lot more about from your failures than you do from your successes. When you have success, you think, boy, am I smart. You know, I'm up there. This is one smart dude. And then the next day or the next week, you have a big failure and you think, well, maybe not quite so much. And that's frankly the way I learned it, the hard way, by making mistakes. And what this book does is when you read it, you'll certainly know a whole lot of things not to do. You will know a whole lot of things to do, and more importantly, specifically, how to do it. And the chances are that many of the principles you'll never need. The reason I have so many is because I ran service businesses. I ran manufacturers. I started and ran manufacturers. I started and ran sales companies. Some sold big-ticket items. Some sold small. I mean, everything from newspapers to million-dollar yachts and airplanes. So there's all kinds of stuff. I sold yachts and I made yachts. And there's a big, big difference on being a manufacturer and a retailer. There are three or four types of businesses. Some are much, much more difficult to run than others. But you don't hear about that stuff in the books. I mean, I've never seen it. I have mm-hmm. it in my book, but I've never seen it elsewhere.
What about Professor, the those who are considered savvy at business? I mean, can savvy? I'm trying to think of another word that would fit in there. Be taught, or like for example, you might take somebody that we'll just use Warren Buffett for example. Okay, be considered a savvy investor. You know,
mm-hmm.
he knows when. When to sell, you know, and there are people in business, entrepreneurs that are savvy, you know, they know, it seems
mm-hmm.
like they make just move at just the right time, and they stay ahead of the game, and they, you know, always seem to be making a profit, and even when their competition is failing, you know, they seem to just prosper. When it comes to being a savvy business person, what do you think contributes to that? Is that something that a person can be taught, or is that innate, or what?
Well, I suspect in some cases, in the Warren Buffett's case, it's probably innate, but it likely is is not that way for everybody. And just remember, Warren Buffett, if you would come to me and say, I want to know, what can you tell me about investing in the stock market, my reaction would be virtually nothing. And anything I would say is really, you don't want to follow my advice, because quite frankly, I have never really done it. I mean, I have invested some little bits here and there, but I'm about as far away from a Warren Buffett as possible to get and still have bought a stock. So just because Henry Ford did well, or somebody else did well in a big, big business, doesn't necessarily mean that they know sic'em about a small business and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I think my book and what I have to say can help a lot in a small business of one sort or another, be it a manufacturer, a retail, or service. I can help a lot there. But if you plop me down in front of General Motors and say, well, they have a labor strike now and they've got a whole bunch of other problems, what would you do? I would tell you to go hire somebody who's been there, because I have not. And so I'm not going to be of much help, because I've never done it. And I think the one thing that you need to do is to have done it. And if you have never done it, chances are what you have to offer is not going to be terribly valuable to people who are trying to do it now.
Well, Professor, before we get into the principles of the book, I just want to ask you to address this one particular point. You know, you stated in past shows, and statistics bear this out, that most small or most new startups fail within the first year. Now, somebody that makes it through the first year could actually fool themselves into thinking, okay, I made it good. You know, I passed the benchmark. I'm smooth sailing. What about the second year? What does statistics show about the second year? If most small businesses or most new startups fail within the first year, are the stats that show how they do in the second?
Well, they do better, but they don't do as well as they should. Each year that they do better and better. That may be partially because there's fewer of them. It also is probably because they've learned a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And I can help people get through all of those years. And one of the ways is to make sure that you do a business plan. And a lot of people say, well, business planning is fine. Doing a real business plan is fine for a startup, but after that, you don't really need it. And that's patently not true. You do need it. And I found I did not do a business plan that was worth the name in the first three or four businesses I started. Well, the first three, for sure. I did not do a business plan to start up that was worth the name. What I did is what a lot of people did. I did a one- or a two-pager. But as far as a cash flow forecast, not really. And, I mean, I did a very crude one, but not much. And after the first year was over, after the actual startup was over, I didn't do it at all. And what changed my mind is I got myself in trouble and almost went bankrupt. And, I dug myself out of that, and I thought as I was digging, I better come up with a method of not letting this happen again, because right now, if I keep doing what I'm doing right now, it probably will happen again. It will not happen exactly the same way, because I know how to avoid that way, but I probably don't know how to avoid others. And what finally occurred to me is you need to plan your work before you work your plan. And so I started doing real business plans, and the more involved I got in business plans, the more money I made, and the fewer surprises there were, certainly much fewer financial surprises. And within 2 or 3 years, I don't know that I would say it was smooth sailing, But boy, I'll tell you, I was able to avoid the vast majority of typhoons out there because I could see them coming a long way off and avoid them because I did business planning. And that was, I mean, I am such a big a proponent of that. Recently, a few months ago, I went down to help some students in the entrepreneurship program at VCU, and I was absolutely astonished at how primitive their business plans were. Some of them had really good products, but as far as how to develop them, they didn't have anything. Not a single one had anything on a cash flow forecast. Matter of fact, they didn't even know what those words were. I spoke to them the last time, and that was one, and I asked them to raise your hand. Does anybody here know what a cash flow forecast is and how to do it? Not a hand went up, not one. And I thought, oh, my God, how did that happen? And the way it happened is because the university – who presumably was trying to teach these kids, wasn't. And the professors doing it, they didn't know what a cash flow forecast was or how to do it.
Wow.
And that was my reaction was, wow. And so they were sending some 70 young people off into the wild world. A few of them, they gave them prizes to get them started. And if they succeeded, it was purely the luck of the draw because it certainly had nothing to do with planning. They had no idea. They just had a good program, a good product. And that was the whole thing, was coming up with the product or the service, and but nothing about real planning. It was astonishing.
Well, as a rule of thumb, or is there a rule of thumb when it comes to the cash, not the cash flow forecast, but the business plan? You mentioned, you know, some people do one or two pages. Is there a bare minimum of when it comes to the business plan? A business plan should be no less than a particular amount, or would that depend on the industry?
Well, it would depend upon the industry and the what you're doing. I mean, if you're going to start a McDonald's, you cannot start a McDonald's on your own. You have to start, and they're going to force you to do a business plan, whether you like it or not. And then they're going to force you to do one every year. So, but if you're in most industries, are you still there?
Hello? Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Yes.
I heard a bing and I didn't know. What I would tell people is go to SCORE, SCORE, and the one I use is score.richmond.org. And SCORE stands for Senior Corps of Retired Executives. And they've been around for many, many, many years. And they have a tremendously good website for business planning. If you go there and you look up, you click on library, and then you click on new business plans, they have one that for a startup is 28 pages. It isn't as bad as it sounds in that there are a lot of pages that have a single sentence on them. But when you go through that, if you follow that and fill that out, you will have the first half of a really good business plan. And then if you go to their accounting place and you do a cash flow forecast using their profit and loss outline, or you could go to my website, theroadtothetop.com, and for $15 download the cash flow forecast, which is in both cases, well, certainly in mine, is a fill in the blanks, and mine is for a very sophisticated business. But if you're trying to, let's say you were trying to do a pizza place, then the vast majority of it you would not need to use, but it would still work fine. But if you were doing you wanted to start a new car agency which has 5 profit centers, it would work perfectly with that. So it would work in a complex business. It works in a simple business. And when you get through, you you have a cash flow forecast that tells you how much money you need and when you need it and what's it for, how it will be spent, where it will be spent, what the income is and what the income comes from, all kinds of stuff. And so what you do is once you've done that, you know how much money to get. So if it says that you need $100,000, you say, okay, I need a minimum. If I'm starting out from a fresh start, I need a minimum of $135,000, $150,000. And if I don't get quite there, I might get myself in trouble. Because one thing is for sure, everything is going to cost more and take longer. I guarantee you that. I don't care how, every time I do one of these things, I think, boy, this time I really got it nailed down. I've got, you know, 8 of them under my belt. The ninth one, I'm going to really have no surprises. And guess what? I had surprises. So it always costs more and it always takes longer. But at any rate, if you have that sort of thing, your odds of success are very, very high. Anybody who would do a SCORE business plan, and certainly if they use then my cash flow forecast, and their chances of failure in the first year is very small. Where if you don't, your chances of failure is probably approaching 50%. It's pretty easy to do.
So to be successful, this isn't optional, right? It's not like somebody can say, well, okay, I'll do the cash flow forecast, but, you know, I'll pass on the business plan, or I'll do the business plan, but, you know, I'll pass on the cash flow forecast.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if you really want to be successful, then, you know, it's not a pick and choose thing. It's not an either or. It's both, right?
It's both. Yeah, it really is. And what you do is you cut down on the surprises. And when you have surprises in a startup business, the vast majority are financial and the vast majority are bad. So, and the definition of being broke is not being able to make payroll on Friday. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference how much money you have flowing in next Saturday, but if you can't make payroll this Friday, by next Saturday, your good people will be gone. Or at least they will be out looking for jobs, and what happens on where you can make it up to them, it ain't gonna work. I mean, that's just the facts, the way it is. And nobody ever said it was going to be easier. It's going to be fair. It's going to be tough. And you know, people work. They expect to get paid. They expect to get paid on time. And excuses are really not listened to a whole lot.
True. Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the book Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. We're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. We are currently up to principle number 77. We're going to start there now. And number 77 is no one can be strong everywhere, but everyone can be strong somewhere. Professor?
Yeah, this is really the only people who have any hope of being strong everywhere is Walmart. And but short of them, there aren't very many. And for a small business, the neat thing about it, you hear people say, well, you can beat the big guy in their own game. No, you can't. There's just no possible way you can do that unless you're just extraordinarily lucky. But if you pick out one little area and you work on that one little area, you will find that you're probably the only one around, or one of the very few around, who is really, really strong in that one little area. And when you do a business plan, one of the things that they tell you to do is do a survey of how big the market is. Well, as a small business, you don't need a really big market. Walmart needs a really big market, but you don't need a really big market. As a matter of fact, you're probably better off with a small market. If you go online and type in lumber, for example, you're probably going to get 25 or 30 million sites that have something to do with lumber.
Mm-hmm.
So you're thinking you're going to start a lumber store. How the heck are you going to get seen?
Mm-hmm.
If there's 25 million,
what
right. that means, I mean, it's not possible. With on the web, if you're not on the first three or four pages, each of them have 10 sites. If you're not on the first three or four, you're never going to get seen. So quite frankly, you don't want to be in a great big market. You want to be in a little tiny market where you can be very strong in that little tiny market. One of the stories I tell in the book is when I started my junior year in college, I was at University of Denver, and I went fishing just before it started. And when I was up there, I was doing pretty well because I had learned to tie trout flies as a child. And one of the things I did is just it's kind of fun for me is to see how small I could make them. And the reason for that is if you've ever been on a trout stream, especially in a meadow, in the late afternoon, the trout are feeding on little tiny, teeny tiny flies. And if you can come pretty close to matching that, you catch lots of fish. And if you can't, you won't catch. I mean, with the possible exception of an imitation of a grasshopper, they aren't going to look at what you have to offer because they're feeding on these little tiny things. Well, I made these little tiny things, and I was catching fish like mad. Guy came along and was watching me, and so I stopped and went, and, you know, as fishermen do, and we, you know, I was a college kid, and he was a much older gentleman, and he asked me what I was catching them on. I showed him, and he said he'd never seen anything that tiny. He bought three of them from me for $10. This was in 1958, and $10 is worth back in 1958 probably about $90 today.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty happy with that, and decided on the way home to see if I could sell them. So I made up some, and I put three little trout flies in a little tiny box and lined them up so they looked neat in a little tiny clear pill box, you know, for medicine. So, and I took them to a store, the most expensive fishing store in Denver, and they bought them. And they gave me $6 a box. I could make three boxes an hour, and they paid me $6 per box. So I was making $18 an hour, which today is about $160 an hour.
Right.
Pretty good, you know.
Hmm?
How would you like to have, as a college kid, be making $160 an hour and work whenever you wanted to and not work when you wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a afternoon date, well, you could go on the date, you know. But this was a little tiny market, tiny, tiny market. But I was the only one in it. And I was charging $6 an hour wholesale for three trout flies, and they were selling them for $10 for three trout flies. You could go into that same store and buy three trout flies for 60 cents. They were much bigger, and they weren't in a cute little box, but you could certainly do it. And the store bought everything I could make. So what's going on here? Trout flies are a very small market, and tiny, tiny trout flies is a little tiny sliver of that little tiny market. But
right.
I was the only one there. So instead of wholesaling them for 10 cents a piece, I wholesaled them for $2 a piece because I was the only one there. So I can't be strong everywhere, but I was very strong somewhere.
You know, that's a very, very good principle that people really need to listen to and to contemplate. Because I think that for a lot of people, when they start off, you know, they have these, you know, visions of grandeur, you know, they want to take over the market, you know, they want to, you know, just control the market, just come in new and just, you know, just take over. And you have to have realistic expectations, you know, so I think, you know, this is a very, very important principle that, you know, stay in your lane. You know what you can do, know what you're good at, know what you're not good at, be realistic, and, you know, like you said, you want to be, it's better to be a big fish in a small pond than to be a small fish in a big pond.
Absolutely. And that doesn't mean that you cannot compete selling lumber. But what you cannot do is compete with Home Depot selling lumber. Now, what can you do? If you want to sell lumber, well, then why don't you sell real fancy tabletops? There's if you look in exotic lumber, you'll find a couple of companies there, and they sell tabletops for $1,500 for a single tabletop. Now, the wood is spectacular. It is absolutely spectacular. They also sell trim, which is about a 16th of an inch thick and maybe an inch or so wide. And all of that is done with this beautiful, beautiful wood with gorgeous grain. It looks like the wood that you'd see in the dashboard of a Rolls-Royce. It is absolutely gorgeous. I have a dining room table that my wife and I made. The trim that goes around the outside costs more than the rest of the table combined. It costs like $25 or $30 for a little piece of trim, an inch wide, a 16th of an inch thick, that's glued all the way around the top of it. It sets it off. It's beautiful. But it costs more than the entire table combined. And I bought that from Exotic Woods. And they have all kinds of it. I mean, but everything they have, expensive as all heck, but absolutely gorgeous. And their attitude is, normally you had to buy 250 feet of it. They had a little remnant that was about 15 feet. And I measured my dining room table. I think, frankly, you may have seen it. I know your wife's seen it because she's oohed and aahed over it. My wife and I put it on and then finished the top of the table. It's a gorgeous table. But the trim, this little strip, an inch wide, 16th of an inch thick, costs more than the whole rest of the table combined. So
Wow. If
you want to be in woods, that's the place to be in as a little guy. And you might be one of 25 or 30 companies in the whole country.
Now that's that. Then your competition is limited.
Competition is limited. None of them want to go on. They don't have any interest in trying to cut prices. Their prices are what they are. If you want to buy from them, fine. If you don't, that's fine too. and they sell to a very limited market, but there's not very many of them there, and everybody does really fine. So don't try to think that you can do battle with a Home Depot or Walmart and win, because you cannot. You will lose. Those guys can give the product away until you go broke, because it's just one tiny, you know, it's kind of like if you were selling farm eggs, and Walmart could give away farm eggs to every one of your customers for the next 2 years, and it would be such a small amount, it would not register.
Mm-hmm.
With mm-hmm. you, it would. You'd be broke. But they don't care. So, and so if you were the that banding that goes around our dining room table, Home Depot has no interest in trying to sell that. It's too small a market. So they don't have any interest in it. And the few people who do want to, they have all kinds of exotic wood items, and they charge a fortune for it.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're going through the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. That was principle number 77. Principle number 78 is also good. Stay as close to home as possible. Stay as close to home as possible. Now, there are a lot of people that are thinking about expanding, Professor. They started their business and they want to expand. What are your thoughts on that? Stay as close to home as possible.
Well, one of the easy ways is to stay. Let's say that you have a ladies' ready-to-wear store, dress store, and you're real successful at it wherever you are. And you say you're here in Richmond, Virginia, and you say, well, gee, why don't I go up to New York? That's only about an 8-hour drive away, and that's a really big market. Well, let me tell you, the chances are of you make it in New York is poor, and the chances of you not destroying your company is very good. What happens when you do that is what you end up doing is you take your very best people. So let's say you have a ladies' dress store that sells dresses and shoes and ladies' hats and, you know, accessories. So you have somebody who runs the dress division, and you have somebody who runs the shoe division. And so you take your two best people and you send them up to wherever. You take my advice and you say, well, instead of going to New York, why don't I go up to Fredericksburg? That's about an hour away. Or down to Virginia Beach, and that's about an hour away. Okay, that's close. And so you send your two big best people there to start up the store. Well, that means that you need to be at your current store a lot more, because your best people aren't there and you have new people there. And your problem is the new store needs your attention, because your best people who are running the store have never done a startup. Only you've done a startup.
Right.
And now the second string is running your main store, and they need your help because they've never really been in charge. So now what do you do? And what often happens is the whole business goes broke, because what you were planning on is your current store is going to keep supplying business and money to the business, and that will be the funders for your new startup. Well, the new startup is eating up money like there's no tomorrow, because it's just getting started, and your new store, frankly, its profits going downhill in a rush because your best people aren't there. if your store is in New York, you got a real problem because you can't go to New York without totally leaving your current store for a day. But if your store is in Virginia Beach or in Fredericksburg, you can leave Richmond at 7:15 in the morning. You're there at the new store opening the door. And at lunch, you tell everybody there that, yeah, well, I'm going out for lunch. And what you actually do is you hop in your car and you go back to your original store and you show up. And your original store, if they're a little slack, you'll come walking in at 1:45 or 1:15, and you find out the staff is all at lunch and the store is essentially closed. If it was in New York, you'd never learn that because you couldn't come back quickly enough.
Good point.
This is, if you're going to do that, you want it as close to home as you can. When I first did that, I had an airplane business in Long Beach, California, and I opened one in Oakland. Well, that was 350 miles away, but I was in the small airplane business. So at 11:45, I could tell let's say I was in Long Beach, and I could tell everybody there, well, I'm going to go on a little short hop over and meet somebody at an airport 30 miles away and have lunch, and I'll be back 1:30 or so. Well, what I actually did, I got in the airplane, and at 1:30 I walked in the store in Oakland, which was at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know I was coming. If they called down, the staff at Long Beach would have said, well, he's 20 miles away having lunch with a friend. But what I was really doing, I was flying up there and I walked in on them. And sometimes I found stuff that I wished I hadn't found, but frankly only found it once, because after that they knew not to do that sort of thing again and that I would just show up. So the distance, when it says as close to home as possible, what it's really talking about is time. In other words, can you show up there in an hour and a half? And if the answer is yes, then it's close enough. If the answer is no, it's not close enough.
You know what's interesting to me, Professor, is, I mean, with you being a pilot, it explains it, but, I mean, you talk about jumping in a plane like someone talks about jumping in a car. You know,
yep.
He's like,
it was, too.
Plane.
It was. The little airplanes, I used them the exact same way as you use a car. I had lots and lots of time in airplanes, and so it was exactly the same way. When I got out of the business, I had over 9,000 hours. But frankly, I hadn't. What I do is I log in my flight log about 150 hours a year, because that's what I needed to have to make it look realistic. Frankly, I probably flew 400 or 500 hours in a year, but I was just lazy, and there was no purpose to it. I had stacks of logbooks that were full, and, to what end did I want to do that? So it was very much exactly like you using the car, getting in a car and driving 15 miles, 20 miles. I hopped in an airplane, flew 300 miles. No difference.
Wow. They never saw you coming, huh?
No, they didn't see me coming. When they saw me coming, usually I walked through the door. Got out of the airplane, walked through the door.
See the coffee spilling all over people. Oh, Lord.
Yeah. The damn boss showed up, and he wasn't supposed to be here. But that made a difference. And then the next one, that was so easy that the next one I did was in Seattle. Well, Seattle was 800 and some miles away. That was 4.5-hour flight, 4-hour flight. and so I couldn't do that anymore. And I had trouble with the Seattle one. I did not have with the store at Oakland. And it wasn't just the people. It was just, it was far enough away that it made management difficult.
So stay as close to home, everybody. Stay as close to home. Well, Professor, we've got only a few, about 10 minutes left. I don't know if you want to try to squeeze in, compare the possibilities.
Well,
I mean, we can hold it. I mean, and we can talk about your other book if you like.
Okay, why don't we do that?
Everybody, as you probably know, if you've been listening for a while, Professor is not just the author of Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, but he's also author of an awesome book titled Finding a Career for Life. And, you know, it's very interesting about that book because in contrast to this book is about entrepreneurship, starting your own business and being successful in that. And the other book is about finding a career for life. If you're going to work for somebody else, there's some things that you need to know. You need to know about if you're going to go to college, or, you know, the decisions that you're making concerning your future. If you're deciding to go to college and, you know, what you're going to major in, there's certain things that you need to be aware of, and that's why that book was written. Professor, can you tell them about your new book? Well, your book has a new principle. Can you tell them about finding a career for life?
Well, yeah, that one, I wrote that after I had lots of my students come in, and I usually taught Saturday classes and evening classes, and the reason was the students were older, they were a lot more serious, and I got lots of students that had been in college, many who had not, who had been out in the real world and had been disappointed. And you'd get people coming in and said, well, I could tell very quickly, or they told me that they had had classes. Many of them had degrees, and many of the degrees just had not led to the kinds of jobs that they thought they would lead to. And I had been around at that time. I'd been out in the world for 60 years. And so I had a pretty good idea of what would work and what wouldn't work. And then I was in academia, and I started asking the teachers and the college administration about some of the career choices that they were offering. And they were offering careers like psychology. And I knew that I had married a gal who was a psychologist who had a master's and had a very hard time making a living. And she was astonishing the way she could listen to people for a very few minutes and know more about them in one case than I knew after I knew the person for 5 years. And it took her about 30 minutes to know more about that guy that I knew. And they just were chatting. And she said, well, you understand he is an alcoholic. And he doesn't right now. He has a drug. He used to have a drug problem, but he is not of that. But he does have I said, he has what? I didn't know that. Well, yeah, that's – and it turns out she was right. Well – And I knew that she had she tried to make a living as a psychologist and was having a hard time doing it, and she was really, really good. So I got to know why that was the case, and basically she said, if you cannot prescribe drugs, write a prescription, you cannot make much of a living. And so when I was teaching in college and people would come to me and said, you know, I'd find out they were majoring in this degree or that degree, and I started to research it and found out that in many, many cases, there was no way they could ever make a real living. Basically, if you're not taking courses in business or STEM – which are the science mathematic courses or business courses, your odds of making a living after you get out are poor. So, for example, I'll give you the if you go to get a degree in psychology, it takes 4 years. And the cost is the same as if you get a degree in petroleum engineering. Bachelor's takes 4 years. The difference is that 10 years after you graduate, if you're making $40,000 to $45,000 as a psychologist, you're doing pretty well. And if you got a degree in petroleum engineering, you should be making $185,000. Costs the same. Your loans are the same. The difference is that you're making 4 or 5 times as much. And that's true in many cases. If you decide to leave, I just met a guy whose son is interested in being a nurse. And I said, boy, that's a terrific choice. And he said, why is that? I said, well, because you can go get a degree and get started as a nurse and get in the job at $30,000 a year is simple at a teaching hospital, and then continue getting degrees and improving yourself. And within 5 years, you should be a nurse practitioner making $140,000, or a year later be having a degree so you're a nurse anesthesiologist and make $160,000. And the chances of you not being able to do that are, I mean, that's going to happen if you get those degrees and you do that, because there is a big need. It's a sustaining need. It's an increasing need. There is no end to it. We are an aging, wealthy society with great medical needs that are covered in insurance, and the insurance companies are saying, how can we cut the costs down? Well, the insurance companies can hire a nurse practitioner or a nurse anesthesiologist and pay them maybe $50 an hour, or they can hire an MD and pay them $200 an hour and get the same thing. So
what if those categories were broken down, say, into subcategories? For example, let's say you take somebody that says, okay, well, you know, I'm good with numbers, you know, but I'm not good with people. You know, I could see myself being an accountant, but, you know, working in a hospital and dealing with people all day like that, and, you know, that's just not my thing, you know. But now let's say you take those type of categories, and they were broken down into, say, subcategories like categories where you're just dealing with computers. You know, you might take somebody who says, you know, and the computer analyst and the accountant and, you know, all of these people that, you know, might not have to have a whole bunch of interaction with people on a daily basis. You might take somebody who's an accountant, says, you know, just put me in the back of the office, you know, and give me my work and I'll do that. But, you know, hey, I don't want to be at the receptionist desk. I don't want to have to greet people when they come in the door.
Sure.
You know, the less people that I'm involved with, the better. You know, how about if could those be even broken down further into categories where you're dealing with people? Because you have somebody that might say, hey, listen, you know, I hear, you know, I understand that, for example, one of the examples you gave was that you don't have to have a college degree to be an airplane pilot, but you might take somebody that says, that sounds great, but I'm afraid of heights. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
there's
all kinds of careers out there. And the thing that my book does is it's the downside for me is that I have to redo it every year because there is change. And the upside for people looking at it, it is very current information, and they can look at what am I interested in, what can I do, and they can look that up in the book, and they'll very likely find it. And it tells them what they can do, what they can expect. And if you want to be an accountant or a computer person, the computer people are going to do really well. Accountants, oddly enough, are going to do real well. And one of the reasons is the accountants will do real well is because there is a tremendous increase in small businesses. Now, small businesses can use computer-aided accounting, but they still have to have quarterly, if they borrow any money from a bank or anybody like that, they're going to have quarterly or at least yearly audits of some sort, and that has to be done by an accountant. So accountants are doing great. And they don't have to be people persons. The same thing is true of computers. Computers have spawned a whole raft of employment out there that pays pretty darn good. I mean, it's not at all difficult to find computers, computer people who mid-career are making $100,000. I mean, that's not unusual at all. So, and they can do it in big business, they can do it in small business. So, there are many, many other, if you look at most colleges, most mid-size or large colleges have degrees that are available in over 100 different areas. The vast majority of those do not lead to a decent job.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't. The college will not tell you that. The college, the professors who teach these things will hype the heck out of them. But the truth is, the only jobs that pay at all well are people teaching that particular thing in college.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that teaching area of it, it doesn't pay worth a darn. And the vast majority of classes or degrees that are offered in college do not lead to good jobs. And nobody is telling these young folks about that. My book does, in very blunt terms. I mean, it's there's page after page of a listing of how much things pay, and then right next to it is analyzing those listings. So it's not just data that you have to figure out yourself. I help you figure it out, but it's pretty obvious what's going on. And I also have hundreds of jobs that give how much they like them. So you think you would like to be a computer nerd because you really like computers. And that turned out to be one of the big surprises that I had, in that the number of people who work in computers who did not particularly like their job. I was very surprised with that. Now, I understood that nurses would probably like what they were doing, but it never occurred to me that computer people would. I thought they would, but they don't. And
you know what's interesting about that is that I would think that the nurses, they might like the pay, you know, and the thought of helping people, but then, you know, seeing sick people all the time and then, you know, maybe having people die on them, you know, that could be depressing, you know.
Well, it would be,
you know,
for
so
me.
I would think that there would have been a larger number of nurses
don't. That is one of the really high ones, that people who like to take care of folks are really dedicated to it. I'm sure they're sad when they lose somebody, but they go right to I lost this person, but I'm not going to lose the next one. So they're very, very dedicated. But
so
that's,
I guess,
what
the reward for
the
them
book, and,
not
the
only
book tells
in the fact
you,
that they're doing what and,
yeah.
You know, providing a service to people, but then the icing on the cake is that it pays well, too. And they can always find a job if they lose one.
Yep.
Or if they relocate to another city,
yep.
another
well,
state,
a,
you know, there's always
that's another
be.
Thing that this book does. It tells you which cities are the best to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a big, big difference. Some cities are just, boy, it's dynamite to go to them, and others, not so much. And it's not what you might think. I almost would guarantee people would be surprised when they go through it. And I have a section on that, what cities to go to. There is hundreds of pages or people, careers on what's called ROI, return on investment. So if you put in so much money to get your college degree, what is the return on that by college, by degree? It's really broken down, and people can go through that. I've had lots of young people who've read this thing through and said, I'm changing. I thought I was going to be one thing, and I am definitely not, because I can see where this goes. And all of them, I have right where all this information came from. So you can sit at your computer, you can read it down, you can type in the address, the computer address, and go right to it and see if I'm telling you the truth, which I am.
Sounds like a great book for seniors in college or even juniors in college. I'm sorry, in high school that are preparing to decide whether or not they're going to college, and if so, what they plan on majoring in. So everybody, if you've got young people in your life, seniors in high school, or juniors in high school, you know, because that is something that a lot of us look back on at, you know, during that time. You're 18, you just graduated from high school, you don't know which way you want to go. You know, some people, you know, decide on the military. Some people decide, well, I'm going to college. Some people decide, well, I'll take a few years off before I go to college. Well, you want to know what you're getting into. You want to know what lies ahead. I mean, you can plan only but so far, but like one of the principals in Professor's book, all decisions should be data-driven. So the more information that you have, then the better for you. So, Professor, let's tell people how they can get both of these books, because I know after hearing the interview on entrepreneurial success, they're going to want that and this another book, Finding a Career for Life. How can they get them?
Well, you can get them at Amazon. The Entrepreneurial Success, you want to put that in and then say 106 Business Principles. When I first started, there was no other Entrepreneurial Success. Now there's lots of them, but none of them say 106 Business Principles. And the other one, same way, type in Finding a Career for Life. And you'll find both of them there. You can also find both of them at my website. And my website is theroadtothetop.com. Theroadtothetop.com.
I've read both of the books, and they are good. They are definitely, definitely good. And, again, you really, really consider getting get them both. I mean, I can't say to get one above, or I can't promote one the other, but I mean, if you've got young people in your life, certainly want to help them to make decisions, because the decisions that they make concerning a career now are going to affect them in so many different ways. It could, the job that they do is going to affect the quality of life, how much they make, where they live. I mean, on so many levels, you know, sometimes people break up because of money issues. Sometimes marriages fall apart over money issues. You know what I mean? So you want to make sure that the career that you choose is going to be a fulfilling one, one that you love to do when you wake up in the morning. If you decide that you're going to go to work for somebody else and not become an entrepreneur, you want to wake up in the morning and, you know, look forward to getting to work and not wake up, you know, just thinking, oh God, I don't feel like this today, you know.
Yep.
So it's gonna definitely help if you love what you do, and on payday you wanna smile when you look at your check. So you definitely want owe it to the young people in your life to get that book. And not just young people. You might want to just be changing or thinking about going back to school, but definitely your decision should be data driven. Professor, again, thank you again for another great show. Everybody, Professor comes on bi-weekly every other Wednesday, so mark your calendar. When we come back, We'll be starting with principle number 79. Compare the possibilities. Compare the possibilities. Really looking forward to that. Professor, thank you for the extended time. I really appreciate you. Great talking to you again. Look forward to the next one.
Okay, so do I. Talk to you later.
All right, take care.
Yep.
Everybody, that's Professor Joseph Geiger. Make sure you get both books. You can't go wrong. Of course, you want to get Entrepreneurial Success 106 Business Principles. I know the last time you tuned in it was 105, but he's added another principle. It's up to 106 now. When you're endeavoring to start a business, that's serious. That's serious. I mean, you're going to have contracts. You're going to have attorneys. You know, all of that is involved. You want to make sure that you're doing it the right way. Okay, it's more than just, oh, I have this great idea. There's a lot involved in it. So you want to stack the odds in your favor. So listen to someone that has done it successfully, been an entrepreneur before the word entrepreneur was popular. Somebody that's been doing it for over 50 years successfully. Okay? Get the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Again, thank you so much. My name is Jawanz. I really appreciate your time. As I always say, you could have been doing something else, but you decided to take time out of your day and spend it with my person and Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Again, see you in 2 weeks when we'll be back with Professor Geiger. But until then, there'll be other shows in between now and then, so stay tuned. Follow the show. All you have to do is just click follow, and you'll be notified every time there's a show. You'll be notified of the day, the time, the guest, and the topic. So, again, thank you so much for your time. My name is Jawanz. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.